Hello, my name is Steve Masler from TroutU.com, and I would like to welcome you to our Cyber Guide series of trout fishing related podcasts. These podcasts will generally discuss in-depth and advanced topics on trout fishing. So, now on to our podcast. Join us for an eye-opening discussion with James Marsh on the importance of understanding and precisely imitating the trout's food sources, answering questions such as, why perfect flies? Why not generic flies? Which are better, dry flies or underwater patterns? What really is a hatch? What are the trout really concentrating on?
Today we're going to talk to James and discuss why he came up with the perfect fly line of flies and what the need of it is for, and just exactly how much work was involved in doing that. And maybe on a later podcast we might discuss more detail of the differences between a perfect fly and a generic fly, and James will explain that later in very great detail. So let's start with James. James, once again, how did you come about recognizing the need for a perfect fly line, and how you came about developing the flies?
It all began with our trying to do a set of instruction videos on the different insects. We were working on a DVD that we wanted to cover all of the mayflies, coast to coast, and caddisflies, stoneflies, and midges as four different programs. Two of those we finished, but there's two that still not quite finished, but this turned out to be a much, much bigger project than we ever anticipated. There's not only lots of the major different sets of species that the trout feed on coast to coast, but also you've got to capture them in the various stages of life. And with the mayfly, for example, the nymph mergers and duns and spinners. So this got to be quite an ordeal. And we ended up with hundreds of hours of video, and lots of that was shot with close-up lens where we could get micro views of the different insects. And we also had, Angie took stills of all of the insects. So we ended up with a lot of information about the flies, probably, as far as I can determine, probably more than anybody. And one day it just occurred to me, well, since I've got all of this information, why don't I develop a fly for each stage of life of each of the insects that trout feed on? And because, in my estimation, there's probably only 20% of the major groups of insects. And when I say groups, there are some, you can't say species, because there's some species that there may be four or five within a genus that all look very close to each other. And there would be no need to have a different fly design to imitate each species. And in other cases, you would need a particular fly for a particular species, such as, say, an eastern green drake, for example. A fly that matched that insect in, say, the dun stage wouldn't match any other insect in the dun stage. And this ended up to be a few hundred different flies. And out of all of those, if you went into a fly shop or even online and started searching for a fly that imitated all of these different categories of insects at a certain stage of life, in my opinion, you wouldn't be able to acquire any more than 20% of them. For some reason, Fly Tires they've got a here at least a quill warden dun, that's pretty common, blue quill dun. And of course, you've got the blue wing olive, but the problem with the blue wing olive is that's a common name for about 30 different flies, probably more than that, that have an olive or brownish olive body and light blue or dark blue wings. In other words, it's very, very generic. a very generic common name. But if you went in the fly shop, for example, and asked them for I was just putting an order together while ago for some folks out west. If you asked them for a fowl, a nymph, that's a small western green drake. If you asked that in the fly shop, you'd get some strange looks because they would probably end up telling you, oh, just use a hare's ear or a pheasant's tail or some generic nymph, because to my knowledge, nobody has ever tied a specific imitation of a small western green drake nymph. They have the duns. I'm not sure about the spinners. I doubt if they ever tied one to imitate the spinners. And I seriously doubt there's ever been one tied to imitate the emergers. There's been flies that tied specifically to imitate a blue-wing olive emerger, but here again, that's a catch-all common name. If you ask for a blue quill spinner, for example, I just mentioned there's Dunn's, that's available in just about every fly shop in the nation, but if you ask for a blue quill spinner, here again, you probably wouldn't find one. And I couldn't quite figure out why it was important to have specific imitations of certain insects, but the majority of them, it wasn't necessary. And the more I studied it, and the more I started reading the history of flies and getting all the books to do with that, which is, oh my goodness, I probably got close to 200 books just on flies or more. It just appears to me that these guys come up with their conception of something that looks good to them and looks like something they think the fish might eat, and they name it either with just a name they get out of the clear blue sky or after themselves in a lot of cases. So I guess probably 95% of the flies is named after something or someone, rather than an insect. So that's how this all got started. And then, of course, I had to begin to put all of this together in a form so I could begin to try to design the flies to imitate the different stages of all the different insects. And that began to be easy because I had to do that in order to produce the DVDs and the videos. We time code all of this stuff that we shoot, and we organize that on the computer under files so we can real quickly go to a close up of any insect in any stage of life. And so that's what we worked on to formulate the basis of what we call perfect flies. And by the way, the name perfect fly came about on this Soda Creek in Yellowstone National Park. We kept watching trout feed in a riffle that Angie was fishing. I was on the video camera, and she wasn't having much success with the fly. And there was obviously a good hatch going on. This was years ago, and we didn't know all of the insects at that point in time. But she got the net, caught some insects, and began to search through the fly boxes we had and came up with an imitation of what actually was a pale morning dun at PND. And she said, this is a perfect fly. And she tied it on, and she proceeded to catch about 20 trout. That stuck with me, and the name stuck with me, and that's where that came from.
James, discuss some specifics now as to why we would use a perfect fly versus a generic.
Well, it's pretty obvious that at any point in time in a trout stream, throughout the season, you've got the trout feeding only on a certain percentage of the insects in the water. And of course, they exist at that point in time as a nymph or as a larva. And only when they hatch, or they're an adult fly, or in the case of mayfly called a dun, And so if you take, for example, right now in Great Smoky Mountain National Park, this is July, most of the mayflies have hatched. There's only a few species out of the 20 or 30 different categories that will hatch until early next year. Those that have hatched are either in the form of an egg now, or they're tiny, tiny nymphs in an early stage. And by that I mean very, very tiny, because they've got a whole, almost a full year to develop. So if you look at it, there's some little yellow quills, which is mayfly, by the way, nobody even knew existed in the Great Smoky Mountain National Park, but hatch in large quantities later on in the early fall. You've got two or three different insects called blue-winged olives that will hatch. One or two of those species are eastern blue-winged olives, which are actually crawling nymphs, not swimming nymphs, or betas nymphs. That's common with blue-winged olives. But and then you'll have the second generation of betas that will hatch in October here. You've got slate drakes. They hatch on and off for about 3 or 4 months. They get a little heavy early in the year. That's already happened. Then they kind of dwindle off. And they're not a bi-breeded insect, but they hatch again in large quantities and usually close to October. And other than that, mayfly-wise, that's about it. I may have overlooked one there. Caddisflies is about the same situation. 60-70% of those have already hatched. And, of course, the Smokies are being, most of the streams having a low pH, a relatively low pH. It's not very conductive to having large quantities of caddisfly, so there's not that many species that exist at this particular place. So you have the fall called the big fall caddisflies that will hatch, October caddis, they call them out west. Here they call them the great olive caddis. And that's about it when you get to the caddis. There's a few more of the small green sedges that will hatch, and a few cinnamon sedges, odd and end hatches, but that's just about it for the caddisflies. But anyway, if you will examine any trout stream at any one point in time in the season, you'll find there's only so many possibilities of trout food there for the trout to eat. And I just went through late July here in Great Smoky Mountain National Park, and there's probably less than 20% of all the aquatic insects that's in the streams available for the trout to eat. So that narrows it down quite a bit. What you do then, you would try to figure out what's the most plentiful and available of those nymphs and larvae. And that's fairly easy to do, because most of these are more plentiful or even less plentiful than the others. So that automatically tells there would be, for example, more blue-winged olives than they would the green sedges that I mentioned that haven't all hatched yet. And once you know your insects and you know them for the streams you fish, you can get a good idea of what the trout are seeing every day and what they're feeding on. And when you present an imitation that looks like what they're used to seeing and eating, your odds simply go up. That's not saying that another generic fly might look like that insect that the trout are used to seeing. The other big fallacy and big mistake that most anglers make is they pay a lot of attention to the dry flies, the flies they fish on the surface, when it's a pure fact that the trout can see the flies that's underwater far, far, far better than the ones on the surface. In fact, they can't even see the flies on the surface unless they're in the window of vision, they call it. This is gets down to physics, snail circle, and depending on the depth of the fish, they only have a small circular area on the surface they can see through to see anything above the water. And if it's a ripple of rough water, not smooth water, that distorts the view. Also, when that fly comes into the edge of that window vision, it's distorted, greatly distorted. It's flattened out and fat, so to speak. It's only in clear, perfect focus when it's directly overhead of the trout. And so, if the water's moving fast like it is, say, again, in the streams of Smoky Mountains, and water's moving quite fast, that gives the trout only a split second. And in those cases, you'll find they can make a lot of mistakes. Everybody says, well, it doesn't matter if you only get a short glimpse of the fly. But how many times have you seen the fly come up and swirl or miss what's really a rejection? Often, I've seen the anglers study, the trout missed it. Well, I doubt that. I don't think they would miss anything they intended to get. I think they simply rejected at the last split second, and realizing it's not something they, you can't say thought it was because they don't have the ability to think like we use the word with human, their brain is the tiny size of a little peanut, but they day in and day out a certain insect. When they see something closely resembles that, and particularly if it's moving, if they only get a short glimpse of it, they will take it. And in those cases where they don't get that real short glimpse, and in all of those cases where they're rejected, if you had a fly that looked more like the natural, more like the real insect, then you would have a higher percentage of hookups.
Well, Jim, you just explained the very basic reason for using the perfect fly versus the generics. Now, you can use a hare's ear or Adam's fly, but if you want to be precise and increase your odds maybe tenfold, you would go to the perfect imitation of the insect that they're feeding on at that time. Is that correct?
Yes, that's one reason. Just a basic reason for not using a generic versus a perfect fly is perfect flies cover the complete spectrum of all the insects that trout feed on. Generic flies don't. I mean, an Adams dry fly is a gray body fly, and the parachute Adams, in my opinion, is probably the best generic fly ever that anyone ever came up with. But on the other hand, say if blue quills are hatching, a blue quill is a very dark mahogany-colored body. And here again, we're talking about flies on the surface where the trout must see that fly in that window of vision and only has a short time. But back to a point I didn't finish all ago was they see the nymphs in the water, under the water, much, much more clearly than they do something on the surface. They can see it much farther away. They can watch it come down and go right past them. And if the water's clear, they get a good view of it. They get probably 50 times better view than they do of a dun getting over the surface of the water. And this is where everybody seems to think it doesn't much matter what kind of fly you use, just a hare's ear or any mouth is fine. And they put all the emphasis on their dry flies on the surface. In my opinion, they do this just exactly backwards. More emphasis should be placed on the flies they're fishing beneath water, simply because the trout can see it much better.
What percentage of a trout's diet would you say would come from emergers or the insects that they see underwater as opposed to the dry flies? My guess is that would be a fairly high percentage of the food they take would be from underwater, as versus maybe a much smaller, maybe 20-30% that would be a dry fly on the surface.
Well, you got the right idea there, but I would give it 95-98% underwater versus just a tiny percentage on the surface.
So that's a real good argument for using the emergers and that type of fly. And how many times have I seen...
That's just a fact. In some streams, the trout rarely feed on the surface.
Yes, I've noticed that, like in Little River, places like that, where you can watch a trout, and he'll see something coming down the stream in the water, submerged, and he'll look at it a little bit and just swim right away.
Well, there's another factor here. A mayfly nymph, for example, is in the water from 1 to 3 years. It's on the water as a gun only a few seconds. It doesn't return to the water as a gun. It returns to the water as a stunner. And then it's only a few seconds. Well, it's longer than a few seconds in the case of spinners sometimes. But the fly, adult fly, let's call it, gun or spinner, is only available less than a minute or two out of a complete year to 3 years. So that should tell you something. And this is the same thing is true with a caddisfly lark. Caddisfly larva emerges, well, several different ways. Unlike a mayfly, they can crawl out of the water and emerge several other different ways. But the point is, they're available to the trout underwater just thousands of times more than they are on the surface. So when you said 20 or 30% versus 60 or 70, I'd say that's far off. I say it's 99% versus less than one. If I just had to take a blanket. Now, there's streams where trout feed more on the surface than they do, you know, in other streams. And there's some tailwaters on the way up where the trout rarely feed on the surface. But if you consider the life of these aquatic insects, when they're available for a year or two or three underwater and only a few seconds out of the water, that makes common sense. You know, common sense of which ones they feed on the most.
Well, James, if we can maybe net that out, a very high percentage in the upper 90s of the trout's food, he will be taken from underwater where he gets a much better view of it. And also the availability of the nymphs, for example, are maybe 3 to 4 years, while they're only on the surface a very short time. So what this tells me is that a fly has to be a very good imitation of this insect, because the trout is, first of all, going to be having a very good look at it, and only feeding on, primarily feeding on the ones that are available at that time in the stream.
Right. Now, there, you know, the big factor here is, I would say, at least 90% of the animals would rather catch one on the surface than catch one underwater. There's a few anglers that just want fish in them, or fish below the surface, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, you're fishing for fun of it, so I don't have any problem with that. I love to catch them on the surface myself, and I fish, if you want to consider trying to increase your odds and catch numbers of fish, I'd probably be a whole lot better off if I fish far less on the surface and a whole lot more beneath it myself, and probably everybody would. So, you know, you have to mention that, because this is what we're out there fishing for. That's fun.
Well, if you're on a surface or fishing a merger under the surface, subsurface, it's far more important to use a perfect replica or imitation of the aquatic insect that's available to the trout at that time, as opposed to the generic fly, which is at best an approximation.
Well, this is certainly true prior to a hatch. Everyone thinks of a hatch as the time the dry flies begin to appear, when really they should be far more concerned with what's happening a week or two before that begins to occur. Because in every case, these insects congregate in a certain part of the stream. They don't hatch all over the water. Ripples, runs, pools, everywhere. They only hatch in certain types of water depending on the insect. And they congregate. And it's not where they live their entire life. I don't know of any of them that hatch exactly where they spend their whole life. They move to usually the slower water, all of the fast water. Insects do all the crawling out and tend to move to slower water, and certainly all of the cleaner nymphs that live in fast water and rely on that heavy amount of oxygen, they move to calmer water to hatch. And so this congregates that food. And although the guy that's doing the fishing may not be aware of that, you can rest assured the trout are. They know exactly what's going on. The reason is they can see it. It happens in the living room where they live. And when they see this happen, and suppose it's, say, a little yellow stonefly. Most of them are called yellow salads. Let's just suppose they don't hatch in the water. They crawl out of the water and hatch. They turn into a fly outside of the water. But they all get in certain types of water in any stream and then crawl out on the banks and sometimes boulders. When those nymphs congregate to do that, it will usually start a week or two before you'll ever even begin to see any of the flies that's hatched. And when that's going on, that's what the trout are concentrating on and feeding on. And if you're just going up the stream, throwing this and that and the other, generic this and that and the other, fishing here and there, you're probably going to hang one every once in a while. But if you want to greatly increase your odds and you're aware that the little yellow stonefly are about to hatch, and you know the type of areas in the stream where they crawl out on the banks, and you key in on those areas, and at that certain time of day, which, by the way, is very, very late in the afternoon, with the little yellow stonefly, it also has to be the same time the egg layers start to come back and deposit their eggs, and everybody wants to swap over to the dry fly and miss out on a lot of those nymphs that's calling out the hatch that night. But anyway, if you wanted to just increase the numbers of fish you catch, you'd stick with the nymph and you'd fish it just in those areas of the stream late in the afternoon. And I'd say in the case of one of the streams here in the Smokies, again for an example, your odds would go up 5 or 10 times what they normally would be. And I could give, of course, dozens and dozens of other examples of different insects, but that's what you, if you want to increase your odds, that's what you need to key in on. And of course, when you do that, you're far better off with a fly that actually looks like the real thing. I don't see how anybody can dispute that argument. I usually get carried away and get aggravating people just in conversation that don't quite buy that and ask them why don't they just take a piece of foam, stick a hook in it, and fish it. Or why don't they, I had a guy tell me one time, he said, oh heck, they hit my legs and my split shot on my line sometimes in this fast water. I said, well, you don't need flies, all you need to do is just clamp on a split shot on a hook. And, of course, I'm also guilty of asking everybody if they believe the generics work so good. Why don't they have a fly box full of different flies? And why, again, here in the Smokies in the spring, why do they worry about whether they've got a blue quill imitation, a blue wing olive imitation, or a quill gordon imitation when those species are hatching? Yet, and maybe a March brown later on, they seem to be concerned that they need a fly that matches those insects, yet for the rest of the year, they seem to be just lost. And it's because they don't know the insects, they don't know what's available and what's hatching. And it gets down to when they're aware of what's going going on, they prefer something like the real things. When they're not, they just use the generics. And the big deceptive thing about all of this is in trash water, it doesn't matter if it's in the Smokies or out west in a small trash water stream, whether it's cutthroat, whether it's brook trout, whatever, if the trout only have a short time to view that fly and just get a quick glimpse of it, they're going to take a lot of generic flies, well, and you can at times catch a lot of fish on those. Angie and I fished Parachute Adams and Harris here probably more than anything. The first 2 or 3 years we fished for trout, we caught a lot of trout. Do we catch what we catch now on our perfect flies? Not even close. And like I mentioned a while ago, if I concentrate on using on fishing underwater and didn't enjoy catching on the dry fly so much, I can just about always increase my numbers.
Thanks for joining us today, and note that Perfect Fly brand flies can be purchased online at troutu.com/store. That's TROUTU.com/store.